You're listening to 9 Plus, a research podcast from SETU Ireland. Welcome to the first episode of the third season of 9 Plus. My name is Rob O'Connor from the South East Technological University of Ireland. We have some exciting episodes about research across the university planned for the academic year, which I hope you'll enjoy as they're released. Today we're talking about a research project that recently finished up at SETU. Portalis was an EU-funded project that explored some of the earliest connections between Ireland and Wales. This is the Mesolithic period from around 10,000 years ago. The goal of the project was to understand how those first human settlers survived and thrived in their surroundings, and if there's any parallels with how we can adapt to climate change today. The project involved a number of partners across Ireland and Wales, but for the podcast, I'm speaking with two members of the Waterford team, Denise O'Mara and Jodie Power, as well as Joseph Schuldenrein from New York, who specialises in geoarchaeology. The conversation starts with Denise and Jodie in the studio in Waterford, before switching to Joe in New York, and then back to Denise and Jodie again. I find this kind of stuff fascinating. Thinking about human civilization over that great expanse of time is a bit mind-blowing, and it also puts some of our issues today in perspective. Anyway, I hope you enjoy the chat, and we'll begin with Jodie and Denise.
My name is Denise O'Mara. I'm a lecturer in the School of Science in SETU, and my role in the Portalis project has been a sustainability officer. And that means that I've been involved in looking at how sustainable our travel has been between Ireland and Wales, but also looking at elements including biodiversity and heritage and the wildlife and natural environment that surround the project as well.
My name is Jodie Power. I'm a Green Party councillor at Waterford City and County Council. I'm also currently mayor of the Waterford Metropolitan District. I am also a lecturer in marine engineering at the National Maritime College of Ireland, now part of the Munster Technological University. And my interest in the project is I'm invited by Joy Rooney to be part of a local inhabitant, basically, of the estuary of Waterford, and also as a public representative of the area, just to have a look, see exactly what the project was about, to try and look at it to see how we can incorporate the project and the results of the project into enhancing the lives of the people in the estuary through tourism, through an appreciation of the archaeological value of where we live, and to promote the area in general. So it was really a fascinating project to be part of. Yeah.
Okay, but let's back up then and describe what Portalis is. So Portalis is a project that you've been involved in. It's just finishing as we record. Denise, I'll go to yourself. What is Portalis? Give me the kind of the high level summary of what the project is.
So the Portalis project is led by Joy Rooney in the Humanities Department in SETU. And it's funded by the Ireland-Wales programme, which is EU funding that's provided under the European Regional Development Fund. And the project also includes partners in Wales, including the University of Wales in Trinity St David, the Ceredigion County Council and the Waterford Chamber of Commerce. And the idea of the project was to investigate what life was like for people who might have first come to Waterford around 8,000, 10,000 years ago. And the idea was to tie in, the archaeological and heritage information with the lives that people would have lived at that time, with the experiences that they might have today in terms of adapting to climate change and how we can use that information to help us adapt to what is a changing environment at the moment.
Mm. Okay, so this is probably an unfair question, but it gets to the heart of it quite quickly. Why is this important?
I think it's important because it's good for us to understand, our history and our culture and the environment that, how the landscape might have looked historically. and what kind of wildlife might have lived in the area at the time, and how we can use that information to help maybe restore some of the landscape and habitats that are important for the conservation of not only our natural heritage, but our biodiversity as well. And that's really important when we look at the news today and we see the effects of climate change. We see it in roads, you know, today, which the island is burning, and, you know, many parts of Europe are struggling with wildfires at the moment. So it's important for us to be able to ensure that our biodiversity is as, I guess, as good as it can be. And that helps make the entire ecosystem more resilient to the impacts of climate change, which not only can cause fire, but they can cause flooding, which impacts our coastal areas as well. So it's important to have an understanding of how the landscape might have looked and what we could do to help restore some of that as well, to help protect it from future disasters, I guess. Yeah.
So to summarise, by looking backwards can help us to look forwards. I know that's probably overly simplistic, but
yeah, absolutely. And I think the Portales project as well has tried to share that kind of knowledge and information with the local communities, and hopefully that knowledge can be used for purposes of ecotourism, for instance. So for instance, if you are aware of what cultural and heritage assets are in the area, which might be kind of, you know, local archaeological sites, or they could be, you know, current sites that are good for wildlife, then we can tell people about them. And that might actually encourage people to come and visit some of the local areas and, you know, just even look out for maybe an otter in the estuary, because we know they're there. And it's a very simple form of ecotourism, but it's actually a very sustainable form as well, because people are more likely to conserve what they know is, you know, beneficial for the local economy.
Okay. So, Jodie, explain maybe what your interest is in this, given that context. I mean, and you can answer with your public representative hat. Mm-hmm. You don't have your mayoral chain with you, but you can pretend to wear it. or with your engineering
hat. Two perspectives. Number one, I grew up in the area. I know Woodstown like the back of my hand. We spend so much time as youths there, walking there weekend after weekend after weekend. So I know the area so well. So when Joy called me and said, Jodie, we're going down to Farnoth Beach down in Creighton Head. Would you come along and have a look and see what's going on in this Portales project? And I was very curious as to what was happening there. So the fact that then I found out about citizen science and about Noel McDonough and what his contribution was to archaeological of the area. This really changed, the Portales project really changed the whole prospect and rewrite the history books, because we really thought that we had a discovery of life in Ireland maybe 5,000 or 6,000 years ago. This brings it back to 10,000 years ago. So I was rewriting the books basically from that point of view. And to realize that this was in my backyard and people have been for generations walking through this wonderland of archaeological discovery and not knowing what was under our feet. So that revelation was just amazing. And all the artifacts that have now come from it that are on display, like in the city hall, in the city, Waterford Treasure Museum there at the moment. So that was amazing. Number two is the fact that from my green perspective, again, how the people at that time adapted to the receding ice age at the time. As the receding ice, we now know down in Creighton Head that the water was 6 metres below where it is right now. So that would have made the whole Farnoth Beach area the land upon which the villagers lived, okay, and survived at the time. And they would have had an increasing or a rising tide at the time, or rising sea levels, and how did they adapt to it as well? So we need to know, okay, basically how they adapted and how they had the challenge of a climate change at the time as well. So from that perspective, yeah, as well, looking at it too. But the main one for me was, how can this push forward what we now know? We have an amazing estuary here in Waterford, okay? Amazing estuary. So many different things, from the species that are there to the fish that are there right there. But now this whole archaeological discovery is opening up the whole place, because we know we have dolmens, we have two major dolmens, 5,000 or 6,000 years old, just within meters, kilometers of the city. And we now know that there was a huge settlement in Killay, which is 2 kilometers from the Fornaught Beach. So if we can interconnect all those together, the archaeological tourism of the area is amazing, what we can bring out. And this is going to really, if it does, with walking trails, with explanation of what's going on, if we can incorporate all this into some kind of a framework that people will want. And don't forget, Southern Europe is burning. Southern Europe, they'll be coming to us for holidays in the years to come, not us going there for a bit of sun. So we got to take full advantage when everybody comes to make sure that when they come here, doesn't experience that they want to come back again. And this archaeological aspect of it in the estuary of Waterford, connecting Cheek Point, Passage East, Dunmurray's and Woodstown, there's so much archaeologically all around there that we need to exploit it to its full and to bring it to fruition. So this is just, I'd say, a fundamental start of what the project brought about in that regard. So then to build on what we've got right now, okay, is the future for us as well. And as a marine engineer, I would love to find out as to how did they travel 10,000 years ago from Wales to Ireland? Even though the sea was down, say, 6 metres, there still would have been quite a considerable sea between England, Ireland and Wales at the time. So how did they bridge that that sea? So I'd love to know that. And hopefully, again, more archaeological digs will bring up that, will bring up an answer to that question. Yeah.
So one of the partners in the project was Joseph Schuldenrein from Geoarchaeology Research Associates based in New York. And Joe and his team did a lot of the actual getting their hands dirty with this machine to take samples deep down. So I'm going to go and talk to Joe now, and then we're going to come back and discuss some of his findings.
My name is Joseph Schuldenrein, and I am the president and principal of Geoarchaeology Research Associates in New York City, and I am involved in the Portalis Project as a researcher and an investigator for scientific purposes and for public outreach purposes.
And Joe, could you explain the work that you did as part of the Portalis Project, and particularly the bits where you came to Ireland and, well, basically got your hands dirty?
The way it started is I was involved with a colleague of mine named Stan Green, who was one of the initial investigators for the early human occupation of Ireland. And this was his research focus for many years. He revived his interest after a long career as being a dean of a university in the United States. And he brought me on to look at the environmental implications and how we use ancient environments to examine questions of human migrations and landscape changes. Because the whole question was, when was Ireland first settled in this part of the country? And how did the landscape look and what were the circumstances of settlement?
And how do you discover that? How do you find out that kind of information?
Well, the first thing that you do is you look at what has been done in Ireland and in that general part of the world. And one of the unusual elements of this is that right across the Irish Sea in Britain, we have evidence of human occupation that goes back literally hundreds of thousands of years. When you cut across the Irish Sea, all of a sudden you don't have a record of human occupation that is earlier than 10,000 years ago. So there is a gap of hundreds of thousands of years in an area that is tiny. And by our standards in the United States, it would be like you would be in one part of a medium-sized state where you have evidence for people hundreds of thousands of years ago, and then you go across a few hundred miles, and then there's nothing for another 390,000 years. So it's a real major question, and it's been a puzzle.
And dare I ask, have you any light to shed on that or any way of solving that puzzle?
Well, we do, because the Irish have been working on this for many, many, many years. And they have essentially structured a model that indicates in very general terms that most of the island was covered by glaciers for almost all of that time. If that's the case, then the only areas that would be available for settlement would be areas that were ice-free. That having been said, it's an island, and so the geography of an island is a little bit unusual. And long story short is that what happened was that the evidence that we found suggested that, in fact, almost the entire island was covered by ice, so that when everything finally got ice-free, which was about 14, 15,000 years ago, that's when we could start looking for evidence of human occupation. And since the southeastern part of Ireland is one of the most ice-free parts of the island, then that would be a very good location for examining these problems.
Okay, so am I correct in summarizing this as saying that there's history of human settlement across the island of Britain for a long period of time, but a very short distance away in Ireland, there's no history of settlement. The reason this is understood is that Ireland was covered by a glacier, whereas Britain was not. But then around about 14,000 years ago, the ice melted enough such that people could start to migrate here.
Perfectly put. Okay. It's a little more complicated. There are some details. But the fact is that the southern part of Britain did have indications of the similar kinds of settlements that's not entirely true. That's the part of Britain that did have the long history. The short history moves up quickly, even in the British side, in the UK side, so that Scotland is also covered by ice. Mm-hmm. So the Scottish record would probably be more similar to the Irish record. And so you only had little pieces, bits and pieces of Britain that were open for human settlement. They were closer to the European continent, et cetera, et cetera. So there's a linkage here, but you can sort of get lost in the details unless you bring it down to detail, to bring it down to the specifics. Mm. And once we started understanding what these models were like, and as the body of knowledge expanded, it ceased to be as much of a theoretical mystery, but you had to go out there and prove it.
Okay, so how did you prove it?
The way we proved it is we banked sort of on the history of Ireland in terms of the archaeology, which we knew reasonably well because of the investigations of Green and his team. And then we started looking at how the landscape had changed, so that we knew that that a very nice glacial history was exposed in the southeast. And that was our first objective. We knew, for example, that the earliest Irish lived on the high ground. The high ground was essentially on the remnants of the glaciers. On the low ground, which is where the beaches are, that's where everything was a problem because most of that terrain is covered now by advancing seas. Mm. So what we ended up looking at was, first of all, looking at the high ground as a separate issue. We found the oldest occupations for a period called the Mesolithic, which started around 10,000 years ago. The high ground was loaded with archaeological evidence of the 10,000-year-old occupations. And then down on the beach, it was loaded with later occupations, which go back to about 4,000 years. And by looking at these extremes on the occupational spectrum, we could put together a more complete puzzle that essentially said that we don't really suspect that there's anything older than 10,000 or 12,000 years ago, depending on where you set the margin. And there's not going to be anything between that area and the coast now because the sea has essentially covered up everything and that the area going to the east is essentially flooded by the Irish Sea, and then you're not going to get any access to it unless you do underwater archaeology, which we're not doing. So we are limited to the beach, which we know is now 4,000, 5,000 years, and the uplands, which is 10,000 years. And that's pretty much the story.
And right, so I'm not an archaeologist, I'm not a history person. explain to me how is it that you find this? I mean, is it a case of like digging and you look for stuff, or what way does it work? I'm sure it's a bit more scientific than that.
No, you're absolutely right. And I think the easiest way to explain this is looking at the fundamentals. And the fundamentals say that if the higher ground was exposed for a very long time, that's where you're going to find the oldest information. So when the earlier teams went out there and they found lots of artifacts that date to the same period, and they're essentially stone tools, which a lot of people would not recognize, but a trained person would recognize it. And they are literally stone tools and some basic structural elements. There's wood, there's bones, and the professionals can put that together. But they're all of a certain style and of a certain type. And when you see that all over the high terrain, you come to the conclusion, if you know what the geological history is, that that's the earliest information that you got, because it's the first area that was ice-free.
Yeah.
So once the ice melted, it left the remnants of the old ice surface, and that's what the people saw. So that's where they were. And so that, so they found that information, not just in the 80s. In the 80s, it was collected systematically. And before that, they knew what it was, but there was very little information. And what they had, they were starting to put together. And so that's how the project worked. Now, on the other side, in Wales, they had similar types of relationships between the land and the artifacts. So the Portalis project tried to put both sides of the Irish Sea together. Our part of the work was on the Irish side.
Talk to me about the nuts and bolts about how you actually did this. So, I mean, you're based in New York. You obviously, this is not, you can't do all this via desk research. I assume you do have to get your hands dirty. So how'd you do that?
I think going back to the original question, which is where I was sort of recruited by my old college friend to get involved in this, he said, let's go out there and see if we can essentially sell this work to the Irish. Because it seemed like an interesting project. There was a very well-known amateur archaeologist who was a brilliant man and unfortunately passed away a few years ago. But he and my friend Stan got together, and that gentleman, whose name was Noel McDonough, had an enormous collection of all these archaeological materials. Those two guys got together by chance at a fair in Dunmore East. And they said, my goodness, we have a wealth of information in this tiny area and something should be done. Mm. And so we brought together C2 as well. And they seemed to be the only interested party that said, this is something that fits in with our grand scheme of expanding public awareness, getting into heritage, conservation, preservation elements of the entire area. And they integrated the project into something that was big. They got the Portalis project that included many components, not just the research, but also the public outreach. And before we turned around, the project was funded. And after we turned around a little more, COVID hit. And so this was on a delay button. And finally, we were able to put together all elements of this project last summer. And that's how we got across.
And what did you do when you came here?
Well, we had a good idea of how to do this. We knew that we had a limited amount of time and resources to put together the project. So what we decided to do was, everybody's fascinated with the earliest. The earliest is always the most intriguing. That is the Mesolithic period. That's the 10,000-year-old occupations. And that was something that the previous project had put together. The question was, how can we integrate that with what's going on the beach? And we looked at all the artifact evidence. And we also knew that we didn't have much of an opportunity to do any field work on the beach because it was all under, a lot of it was in the tidal zone. So what we did was we identified a means of doing this work by using what's called a geoprobe, which is a machine that can go out in the tidal area and punch little drill holes under the surface, even in shallow water, and recover the dirt and the materials that would tell us about the ancient landscape. We knew from McDonough's work that the artifacts themselves were much later than the ones on the high ground. So we wanted to get whatever information we could get about the landscape to put together the landscape and the archaeology. And that was our job. We spent 3 days drilling in the tidal zone and literally running away from the tide as it advances during the day. So we punched our holes in the ground. We collected about close to 100 tubes of dirt and pulled it out, got the information, because that's all layered. All those tubes have layered deposits of dirt that were very interesting, but the whole point was to get as much information as we could, because it'll never be done again. And then C2 gave us a place to store it, and then we started actually looking at the dirt, and that's how we got our information.
Did you have any surprises?
We did. We didn't realize exactly what the timing was of sea level change. But because we were able to get radiocarbon dates from great depths all the way up to the contemporary depth, we were actually able to construct a model of sea level rise, how quickly it rose, because the organic material gave us the dates. When people came in there and actually where the sea level was at the time that they were there, and we were able to put all this information together. We also had evidence of intact archaeological features, cooking areas that dated to the period of the sea level changes, and all that information mixed together, the cultural data, the natural data, the landscape data on the vegetation that was there, and ultimately put all that material together with climate information. So we had an integrated model of people settlement, climate, sea level rise, ancient landscapes, transformations of everything, and how human activity responded to changing climate. And that was the real major story of what we did.
Would it be fair to say that this is like a bit of a detective story, in that you have small pieces all around the place, and it's only when you maybe put them all together, take a step back, that you can get the bigger picture? Is that, or am I being reductive in saying that?
That is exactly what we're doing. Okay. And you're just looking at it from the greater picture, and that's why they use archaeologists very often for forensic studies. Because it's exactly what it is. You put together a period of events that are bits and pieces of a puzzle, and then you're able to assemble all that information, and then you have a reconstruction of things like climate, sea level, human occupation, adjustment to those things. And that's how we can essentially use the past as sort of a mirror of what's going to happen with climate change. And we say, well, here's what happened 5,000 years ago. Here's what happened 10,000 years ago. Here's what happened 200 years ago. And we can tell you what's probably going to happen going forward. So there's actually an application for these kinds of information going forward. And I think Portales was designed to some degree to do that.
One of the things that really struck me from talking with Joe was that Ireland was settled much later than the island of Britain or the rest of Europe. Now, I didn't know that, but I mean, I suppose, why would I? I'm neither an archaeologist nor a historian or anything like that. But to say that Ireland was, we often talk about the old culture that's here in Ireland, and it is an ancient culture, but that it was settled 10,000 years, about 10,000 years later than the island across the water. To me, that's kind of mad, you know. I don't know what your thoughts on that are. You're probably looking at me going, yeah, everyone knows that.
Yeah, I think there's a lot we still don't know about Ireland and how it was colonised and when people eventually got here. Some of the earliest, findings of human presence in Ireland actually came from a brown bear bone. and there was this brown bear bone found that had butcher marks on it, and it was radiocarbon dated a couple of years ago, and they found it was about 10,000 years old, and that was kind of like some of the earliest evidence we had of people in Ireland that they were actually butchering bears. And that was worked by Marion O'Dowd and Ruth Carden and a couple of other people as well that were involved in that. But I think it's interesting that, you know, we don't know a whole lot about the people that came here and, you know, what they might have experienced when they did arrive to Ireland. And I was fortunate to read Joe's draft report. And I think it's, you know, my interpretation of it is as an ecologist, I'm not an archaeologist or a historian. So my interpretation is very much using the information that Joe gained to kind of provide a picture of the landscape. And yesterday we gave a talk and a walk at Creedenhead to the Waterford Historical Society. And I used my interpretation of Joe's findings to give people a visualization of what the area might have looked like when the first people might have been in Ireland. So Joe's work showed that the core samples that they took, they were dated, radiocarbon dated, to about the earliest date was 8,000 years ago. So what Joe was able to show was that at that time in Ireland, and in that time down around Woodstown and Creedon, the area was dominated by Scots pine forest. So Scots pine is our native pine tree. And if you stood looking down at the Fornock Strand today from Creedon, it would have been mostly forested. And even where the tide comes in now, that would have been a forest. And when the tide goes out today or after like a heavy storm, you can see the remnants of that ancient forest there in tree stumps. And that's, you know, an insight into how the landscape would have looked. And if you think back 8,000 years ago in Ireland, when people would have been presumably living in the area and trying to, you know, carve an existence there, they would have shared that landscape with the brown bears, you know, wolves, and lynx, and they're all species that are extinct today, and, you know, they're not going to come back without, you know, us reintroducing them. In other parts in Europe, brown bears and wolves and lynx are starting to recolonize areas where they previously went extinct, but that's not going to happen in Ireland. So what we've left today is only kind of, you know, a partial, I suppose, assemblage of what used to be there. I think it's kind of interesting to think that, like, when people came here, they would have had to share the landscape with all of these wild mammals that we, you know, don't have here anymore. And I suppose looking at Joe's report as well, he said that, you know, in addition to like the Scots pine, other native trees existed there as well. So like oak and hazel and elm and alder and birch and willow. And oak, when we think about how valuable an oak tree might have been to those people, like elsewhere in Europe today, they still use acorns to feed pigs and things like that. So they might have been using, you know, a lot of the resources that were there to rear their first animals and to keep them, to domesticate them. And it's interesting as well, because how did they protect, you know, their livestock from the environment around them? It must have been a difficult environment to live in. And we were yesterday as well, we were imagining how, you know, even the likes of brown bears probably fed off the salmon in the estuary. And, you know, it might have been like, you know, a bit like Alaska today. You know, when you think about it, it's kind of amazing to think that that was how wild, you know, Ireland was. And there was an interesting aspect in Joe's work as well, where he showed that around 4,000 years ago, the landscape actually changed. And there was a period of wet weather for about 500 years. And, you know, looking at today's weather, you could kind of imagine how it happened, all right? But during that time, the landscape changed again. And the pine trees actually decreased, and some of the area around Creedon actually became quite boggy and wet, and there was like a fresh water lake or bog came into existence at that time. And it was a lot more kind of like grasses and plantain and other wet water plants started to develop. And the pine would have decreased, other species like the hazel decreased as well. And it was an interesting period. So the people at that time would have had to adapt to this change in their environment. And 500 years is a long time. And if we took a 500 year snapshot of our lives today, we'd probably see, you know, a period of, you know, uncertain climate and things like that as well. So I think there are some parallels between life 4,000 years ago and as to what we have today. And after that wet period, the landscape changed again. So instead of a pine dominated forest, it became more of an alder dominated area. And there was still plenty of oak and things like that as well, but the pine decreased quite a bit. And that suggests that the landscape was a bit wetter at that stage as well, that it continued to be wetter. And that period lasted up until about 1800 years ago. So I just thought it was fascinating to think that we can imagine the landscape based on this core analysis. Mm. And, you know, as time goes on, I'm sure we'll start to build better visualizations of the landscape and, you know, the struggles that people might have had during that time and how they might have existed and coexisted with the species that we no longer have in Ireland. Because, like, wolves lived in Ireland up until about 300, 400 years ago. Cromwell got rid of the last of the Irish wolves, yeah.
Jesus, it's just another black mark against them.
And the oak, and all the oak, the oak forests.
That's true, actually. They use them. They exported all their oak.
For the ships, the navy ships.
And like apparently Cromwell said that he couldn't tame the Irish countryside while wolves still roamed it. So that was part of his kind of idea, I suppose, to get control of the Irish people. You had to control the land. And that's why they eradicated the last of the wolves.
I don't know what to say about that.
From my perspective on it, from what I got from the project as well, and I'm a marine engineer, so mechanical engineering is my thing. But I did a master's degree in marine affairs, and again, looking at the seabed and how coring in the seabed and on mountains, right, told us exactly what happened with plate tectonics on the world going back millions and millions of years. So that was really, really interesting. And from what Denise is saying with regard to coring, okay, with regard to down in Woodstown, you can see then the layering, as she said, each layer that you go down, you core, you can put it horizontally on a table, and you can look at each what was happening and how many hundreds of years or thousands of years was in each one of those cores. That tells you exactly what the story is, what was there. So it's a fascinating science, and I think you're going into it. But I think for me, why we were 10,000 years after everybody else, say Europe getting, or the island next door being inhabited, I think the ice age that we had here, a little bit further north, so the ice age was down here. So by the time, ice takes a long time to recede. So as southern England became open, okay, after the ice melted, okay, people were able to migrate from Europe, because you can actually see the southern coast of UK from France. So people were able to jump that gap, as it were. And as the south coast of England then became inhabited, and as the ice receded, inhabitants went up. Because again, I'd say it would have been very fertile, the land, as the ice left, okay, and there was virgin soil underneath, it would have been very fertile. And as the pointed out, I mean, say the people used the land to survive, and if it was very fertile, nuts, trees, or whatever it is growing that was there, they were able to survive on the berries. And eventually, like a couple of thousand years later, Ireland then became exposed from under the ice. And again, only natural curiosity of man being always looking forward to finding out what's beyond the next horizon. That's part of who we are and our DNA. So this is how Ireland then became inhabited, and so much later than the rest of it, as the ice receded, basically.
I'm still kind of flabbergasted that that this area, this southeast of Ireland, was the first human settlement on the island. Because I automatically assume, oh, it was somewhere in Dublin or somewhere around there, just because it's now the population centre. Yeah. You know, but obviously, you know, 10,000 years ago or 8,000 years ago is vastly different. But, you know, it's hard to get your head around those kind of numbers, or certainly it is for me, to think that far back, because it's almost alien. Even though I know it's not, but it's almost alien. You know what I mean?
We've come on so much as a species. We've come on so much, okay, in, say, the last 10,000 years. Well, from 10,000 years to 5,000. I'd say in the last 1,000 years in particular, or whatever. But, yeah. Here we are today.
So at the time, so we're recording this now, Portalis, the project is just finishing up. What is the next step, or is there a next step? So Denise?
Well, one of the things I've been talking to Joy about is that we're very interested in the School of Science to develop a biodiversity and sustainability forum. And what we're hoping to do with that is to involve local community groups as well as maybe some local businesses in the region, and that we would develop, I suppose, a series of resources that would be available to the different groups that they could use to help develop biodiversity projects in their local areas, and to help provide, I suppose, the knowledge base that could be used to do that. And we think there's a lot of interest, particularly within a lot of the stakeholders along, or the community groups along the Waterford Estuary, that would be keen to kind of develop biodiversity projects on the back of something like Portalis. And that's kind of the avenue that I'm interested in. I know that Joy is very interested in continuing on a lot of the archaeological work and things like that. So there, I think there's huge scope within the project, because it was just a pilot project and it touched on so many different things that it's very much wide open in terms of where it can go next. And there's so many possibilities and routes, from research and innovation to developing ecotourism opportunities through further walks and trails, and even enhancing, I suppose, the local areas to, you know, provide, I suppose, you know, better habitats for wildlife and things like that, mm-hmm. so that we can encourage more ecotourism opportunities. Like in parts of the UK, they have like wildlife hides and things like that. Like people will go to some of the islands in Scotland to photograph otters, but we have them all throughout the estuary. Like they occur everywhere along the King's Channel, mm. all the way down to Cheek Point, to Woodstown, Creedon, all the way to Dunmore East. And you know, there are opportunities that we could avail of to develop more eco-friendly tourism options that, you know, currently we're not even aware of or even investigating, but they work elsewhere. And I think once we have developed a lot of this knowledge base, opportunities can come of it, and they can be very beneficial not only to the university but to the local community groups, and, you know, help increase, I suppose, awareness of the area as well, and help promote the region.
And with that chime true with you, Jody, would you agree with that?
Or? Absolutely, yeah. I think right now we're facing such a problem with our extinction of species that we have even today. Right now the salmon in our rivers are almost gone, the eels in our river, and this is all in our watch and our generation. And I say, to say that we're sitting back and doing nothing about it, or doing very little about it, we're talking about it but nobody seems to be doing anything, because the ecology of our estuary is under serious threat right now from so many different factors. We need to stop and take a look at this and say, listen, stop, and reverse what's going on. And again, by doing it right, getting the science right, that hopefully this project will open up avenues in the ecological perspective, like for the estuary, to try and get the science right so that we can start reversing this. Because if we keep on going the way we're doing, we'll eventually end up destroying ourselves. Okay, and again, that's nothing to look forward to. So, but from other thing, as I talked about, part of our development plan in Waterford City and County Council going forward for the next 5 years is to develop a blue way to complement the Greenway, going from the city centre all the way to Cheek Point, all the way to Passage, and all the way onto Dunmore East, and again eventually going around the coast where the walkway is already on the coastal line as far as Port Tally right now, and bring it into Brownstown Head and into Tremor. So again, that will bring up the tourist trails that you're talking about, really open it up to fantastic, you know, the scenery there down along the river, the estuary, and along the ocean is just amazing. But also to incorporate not only that, but incorporate the rich archaeological heritage that we have there, and to bring that into perspective as well, because again, it's something that we haven't tapped into at this stage yet. And I'd say it's just bursting there to come out and to blossom and to get people really excited about what's going on. So I think from that perspective, looking at it from the estuary, from the villages on the estuary, to get to really buy into it, I think there's a huge potential there for our future. So.
If you want to learn more about Portalis, the project, and its findings, check out portalisproject.eu. There's also a film. There's a short movie up there as well.
Yeah, it was directed by Dr. Moira Sweeney. She's a lecturer in the film studies area here in C2.
Ah, right, okay.
Yeah, she's very good.
Yeah, so and there's all sorts of reports and things. There's lots of photographs up there as well, so it's quite visual. The website. There's a nice style on it as well. I like the colours. Yeah, I know that's reductive, but I do like it. It's not a boring website.
No. And the virtual reality display that I went in part of down into the Waterford Treasures Museum, right? That was really interesting as well.
Okay.
The virtual reality. You can actually see a piece of flint or whatever, or a piece of old whatever tool they were using at the time. It's on display there, and then you can use your VR goggles on and actually bring it right up and turn it around in your hands as if it's right there in front, and see exactly how you know the whole makeup of it and whatever. So very, very, very well done indeed, actually.
I have to check that out, actually. I haven't done that one. I must
really good.
Take the kids in. They'll enjoy that.
Totally.
Maybe one of those rainy days.
Thanks
to them. To Jody and Denise, thank you very, very much. Also to Joe for talking earlier. Portalisproject.eu, and I very much look forward to seeing where this goes in the future. Folks, thank you.
Thank you. Best of luck.
Thanks for listening to this episode of 9+. You can learn more about the project at portalisproject.eu, and we'll be back with more interesting discussions in a couple of weeks.